TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Peter Dale Scott, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. The Poetry Room upstairs at City Lights Bookstore and Publishing House in San Francisco, filled with friends, authors, journalists, and bloggers, to celebrate the 2014 publication of Deep State by Peter Dale Scott. Peter Mirabalis is the events coordinator at City Lights. After giving the introduction, he settled into a rocking chair by the window to participate in a talk and Q&A about who really is pulling the strings in the US of A that once was known as a democracy. He is Peter Mirabalis. Welcome.
It really is a delight to have Peter Dale Scott back in the house again. He is no stranger to City Lights. Professor Scott is a political analyst, a former diplomat, a poet, and professor emeritus at the University of California in Berkeley, and the author of Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, as well as American War Machine, Deep Politics, the CIA Global Drug Connection, and The Road to Afghanistan, as well as numerous other titles. He's been awarded the Lannan Poetry Award. So tonight, we are celebrating a new book, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. This is from Rowan and Littlefield Publishers, and it examines a form of shadow government that's emerged in the U.S. since the Vietnam War, the increasing militarization of culture, restrictions on constitutional rights, and the income disparity are the backdrop for a war fought against American citizenry for power and profit. So the American Deep State looks at the alliance of both public and private entities that have willfully participated in a series of interventions relating to, as Professor Scott defines them, structural deep events in history. And American Deep State shows how there's now a supranational deep state, sometimes demonstrably against both the White House policies and American public interest. So please join us in giving him a very warm welcome. Sir, welcome to City Lights.
I want to begin by thanking you all for coming, and I want to thank City Lights, and above all, Peter, who's been my host, three times now, for this event. I'm going to start with this book and its cover. Those of you who have seen the cover, has anyone identified the big plane that I've put on top of the White House? This is not an actual photograph. It's a composite of two photographs. This is not Air Force One, as a lot of people guess. It's an E-4B. And do I have to explain, as I suspect I do? It's also called the Doomsday Plane. It is the plane which was worked out as part of the Doomsday Project I'm going to talk about tonight, continuity of government planning, COG planning. I do, in fact, call it change of government planning because it was implemented on 9/11, and we, because of the implementation, we have seen some very real changes. And on that day, at about 10 o'clock, CNN captured a video which I give you a URL for. It's the first prose in the book is an explanation of the cover. CNN actually saw the E-4B above the White House and explained that's why there was this sudden exit from the White House, because there was a plane overhead. You may know that that's forbidden airspace. No plane is ever supposed to be there. The E-4B, which is for the use of the president, it's for national command authority, the president, the secretary of defense. The president, of course, was in Tampa, and the secretary of defense at about this time was helping put people on stretchers outside the Pentagon building, which seems an odd thing to do when your nation is under attack, but that's what he apparently did. So why was that plane there? We don't know. Why did CNN take the news clip off their website? Luckily, somebody had captured it, and it's back up from somewhere else. But it's apparently something we're not supposed to know about. And that's why we really have two kinds of history in this country. We have history that is in the newspapers and in the books of people who do archival research, some of them very good books, but there are some events which are either never in the newspapers and media or withdrawn from the media once they're in. And to poke around with those data, which I think you have to do, gets you from one point of view into what I call deep history, and that's what this book is about. Or if you don't like people doing this, you say that's conspiracy theory. Well, it's been a long time since my last book, 5 years, and I actually had a manuscript already at the beginning of 2011, which is, I think, the date in my contract. I was beginning with an essay about continuity of government, COG. I gave a talk at the Commonwealth Club. I see at least one face in the audience who was there, I think. And it's very serious to me that Ronald Reagan in 1982 set up a committee to plan for or to deal with existing plans, quite legitimate plans at the beginning, to deal with an atomic attack. What do you do if the nation is decapitated? You lose the president and the vice president and the Speaker of the House. How are you going to handle the succession? So you have to do something beyond what the Constitution is talking about. But they created a committee, and it had people in the government and people not in the government. And by the late 1990s, when Clinton was president, two people who had been on it from the very beginning, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, neither of them were in the government, and yet they were planning for what one journalist, Chardy, called suspension of the Constitution, which is about right. They were planning for suspension of the Constitution, even though they had no governmental status except being on a secret committee that had been appointed by a president no longer in power. And Oliver North was working on this at the time of Iran-Contra, and he was actually asked about it in the Iran-Contra hearings. Is it true you're planning for suspension of the Constitution? And he never gave an answer because the chairman of the Senate committee, who was a Democrat, banged his gavel and said we would have to go into that in an executive session, which is more or less confirming that, yes, that is what he was doing. And it's also secret. We don't know whether there ever was an executive session or not. There are books that say that Congress really didn't know what was happening, even though the plans included the massive evacuation of Congress to these hollowed-out mountains around Washington. So it was very high secret stuff. And it became clear, even before Iran-Contra, that it was now being used with other ends in view, and particularly one which caught the eye of journalists then, massive detentions, warrantless detentions. In fact, there were three elements that were described by more than one journalist. The first one was warrantless surveillance. We all know about that now from Edward Snowden. The second was warrantless detention. And the third one was called back then martial law. Well, in a sense, all three were implemented on 9/11, except you have to qualify about martial law. They did not technically get martial law, but we have definitely seen, and it's been on our TV cameras recently, the militarization of homeland security. In many ways, what you see are these really armed personnel carriers and very heavy duty military equipment given to police forces. I think much more important is the fact that in 2002, they created an army command for continental United States, so that just as they have a command for South America, Southcom, now there's one for Northcom. And do you all know that we have been in a state of emergency ever since September? Two states of emergency, actually, since September 14th, 2011. There is a law passed after Watergate, one of the Church Committee reforms. It says that Congress shall review any declaration of a state of emergency and either affirm it or let it lapse. It's supposed to do that in 6 months. Well, we've gone now for 13 years, and it still hasn't happened. And when a former congressman and I tried to mobilize some public opinion to get it to happen, one of the congressmen told a constituent that that law isn't in effect anymore because of COG. And if that's true, this is a single hearsay statement. I can't verify if it's true or not, but if it's true, that would certainly mean that, in effect, the Constitution has been suspended. So how could this happen? When I started to write this book, I had written first about a deep state back in 2007, and then again in 2010, but I was almost apologetic about using it because the term deep state comes from Turkey, and there refers to an organized parallel government set up, I think, with CIA encouragement 30 or 40 years ago, involving gangs of killers. And you have that in Turkey. You had something like that in Colombia. You could argue by extension that you had something like that in Italy. I don't think we have something like that in America. And so maybe I'll begin with somebody else's definition of... Well, a couple of definitions. In the Washington Post, not long ago, Dana Priest and William Arkin said, there are now, and this is a quote, two governments, the one its citizens were familiar with, operated more or less in the open, the other a parallel top-secret government whose parts had mushroomed in less than a decade, in other words, since 2001, into a gigantic, sprawling universe of its own, visible only to a carefully vetted cadre. Now, there was a man called Mike Lofgren who was on the Bill Moyers show at the beginning of this year, and he used the term deep state for America. And he added to that notion, if we start peeling the onion and behind the level of the public state, you see agencies like the NSA and the CIA, which is, maybe I'll have time to explain, really are very, very marginally controlled by Congress. They have, particularly the CIA, their own access to their own funds. So budgetary control does not exist for them. And yet you have another level, what I call the private intelligence corporations, Booz Allen Hamilton, which I talk about in the book, SAIC, which I talked more about in the American War Machine. These private corporations get most of the intelligence budget now, something like 70% of the U.S. intelligence budget, which is like $60 million a year, we're talking big money, is outsourced to private corporations, and they have links not just to the Pentagon and to the CIA and to NSA, but they also have links to big U.S. corporations. And in fact, Booz Allen, its history was working for the largest U.S. corporations, first at home and then since 1953 abroad. Very interestingly, that they went abroad to exactly the countries that the CIA in 53, Dulles has just become the director. It started mounting extensive operations in the Philippines, in Egypt, and in Iran, and that is exactly where Booz Allen also went. And I trace one, I think, important individual, Miles Copeland. He started by working for the CIA, and then he shifted over doing the same thing, doing it for Booz Allen Hamilton, but now, of course, completely beyond congressional control. And then finally ended up as the senior aide to a man called Adnan Khashoggi, who was making millions and millions of dollars in percentages of defense contracts with Saudi Arabia, which were then used to subsidize projects which before then had been subsidized by the CIA. This is all very important. That level is important not just because they get so much of the U.S. intelligence budget, but because they blend into a world of corporations and banks and above all, oil. Booz Allen definitely had big contracts with what I call big oil, the old Seven Sisters, as they were back in the 50s. So you have the level of the CIA, NSA, the level of these outsourced corporations. And finally, where I think you really have to look for the ultimate seat of power, the corporations that financed firms like Booz Allen before the CIA financed them. And I think we can point specifically to Wall Street and to Big Oil. Big Oil was very centered in New York in the 1950s. It was operating as a cartel. Truman and his Justice Department were threatening to break up the cartel. They demanded to see certain documents, and the oil companies said, unfortunately, we can't produce these documents that would betray national security secrets. And they sort of delayed and delayed and delayed until you had the 1952 elections, in which Eisenhower, very much supported by Big Oil, won the election, and he put into, as Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, and as Director of CIA, Allen Dulles, from the law firm Sullivan and Cromwell that had been fighting on behalf of the oil cartel and managed to get the criminal. There were criminal charges against the cartel which were dropped, and the oil companies have since continued to operate as a cartel. They can manipulate oil prices. I think, frankly, we're seeing manipulated oil prices now as we're trying to punish Putin for what's happening in Eastern Europe. Certainly, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you saw manipulated oil prices in the 1980s when they were trying to bring down the Soviet Union, because Gorbachev had planned all these big reforms for Russia. And he suddenly had no budget to do it because the price of oil dropped to, what was it, $16 a barrel or something like that? And then, of course, went back up again. These are not market-determined operations. These are covert operations in which the CIA, I've read an interview with a senior CIA officer who boasted about the CIA role in that. CIA, the oil companies, and I'll have to say more about this, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has become a kind of working partner of Big Oil because they are the major linchpin of OPEC. Well, I could say much more about that. Let me give you an example of what I think proves that the CIA isn't just working for the U.S. government. It is working for the deep state and the and for Wall Street. And let me, even before that, give a quotation from Franklin Roosevelt in 1933, wrote to his friend Colonel House in a private letter. And he said, "You and I know that financial interests in certain major centers have controlled this government since the age of Jackson." So that is a very deep historical perspective for the existence of what I call the deep state. I would actually take it back to the American Revolution. There's a very interesting new book just come out called The Counter-Revolution of 1776. Has anyone heard of it? And it offers a major reason why the wealthy interests of America wanted independence very rapidly was because England was about to emancipate slaves. And they were going to do it not just for England, but for the colonies. They did do it for the colonies. And if the Americas had still been a colonies, well, then South Carolina, for example, which was 60% black and had a pretty steady, continuous history of slave uprisings, would have been faced with a very serious problem. So that's why this book says it was a counter-revolution. My view of the American Revolution is much more complicated. I think it achieved some things which were radically new for history, but they also preserved an institution which was artificially prolonged in America when it was being abolished in the rest of the world. So, yes, I think there's always been a deep state, but something has definitely happened, as the other Peter said, since World War II, and particularly since the death of Kennedy in the Vietnam War. And another event, I won't have time, I think, in my speech, but the Reagan Revolution really was a revolution. Roger Morris called it a coup. It saved the CIA from the kind of congressional scrutiny that was developing in the Carter administration with Senator Church. You know, we're still seeing that debate today, even. The release of the torture report is another attempt by Congress to assert its priority over the CIA. According to the Constitution, Congress is more a part of the ruling structure of the country than the CIA. The last time Congress did something like that, it produced the Reagan Revolution or counter-revolution, and I expect to see some kind of response to this quite radical step that has just been taken by releasing the torture report. So the Reagan Revolution changed things and set in motion this set of secret plans with a budget. There was something like $7 or $8 billion a year was being put into continuity of government planning. They created a separate network. And that's how Ollie North was able to get arms to Iran without the State Department knowing about it. He used the network that had been set up for continuity of government, and he used it to send arms to Iran. In my book, I suggest that what I call the major deep events, starting with the Kennedy assassination and including Watergate, I throw in what they call the October surprise, the planning to get rid of Carter in 1980 by delaying the return of the hostages that had been taken in the Tehran embassy. That's the October surprise. Certainly Iran-Contra, they all used this secret network. And on 9/11, it was officially implemented. And that, by the way, is, I think, why on that day, if you remember it, President Bush spent most of the day not in Washington because the vice president was there. That's part of the COG plans, that they not be in the same place. And then when Bush came back about 3:30 in the afternoon, Vice President Cheney immediately left and went off and lived in a hollowed-out mountain, one of the Site R, or one of those structures, for about 90 days with a staff of 100. What were they doing? I think they were putting the finishing touches on the Patriot Act, and who knows what else they were doing. I mentioned Operation Endgame. There was a plan for the emergency warrantless detention of numbers of people, large numbers of people, and that was implemented in 9/11. Everyone's upset about the warrantless surveillance because it affects all of us. But I personally, as a Canadian, I feel I've been surveilled for quite some time by this government, and they're very polite about it. It hasn't upset me. But the warrantless detention is something else. There were about 1,000 Muslims. We don't even know how many. But more than 1,000 Muslims rounded up right after 9/11. No warrant, no explanation. I don't want to say that they were tortured, but I did meet one of them who was an academic. And he wasn't even an Arab. He was a Shia Muslim from Iran. But they rounded him up, too. And they beat him so severely that there was blood in his urine. And they held him for 80 days. And then said, okay, go away. Don't talk about this. I don't like analogies with Nazi Germany, but I do feel this one. All this happened to Muslims, and the rest of us don't seem to care. And I think we should care, because if they can do that to 1,000 Muslims, they can do it to anybody. And finally, because we're in a state of emergency, there is a brigade now, a U.S. Army brigade I don't want to say permanently stationed, it's to deal with the emergency, but they went there in 2008 and they're still there to deal with any form of civil arrest that local police cannot control. So you may never see anti-war riots of the kind that you saw back in the 1960s. They have been planning rigorously to make sure they never happen again because, as Oliver North said in his testimony, he pointed his finger at one of the congressmen and said, "You and I know that the war in Vietnam wasn't lost in Vietnam. It was lost right here in the streets of Washington." Those people believe that. Those people have planned to make sure it'll never happen again. And because I believe that a healthy democracy needs forces for change, you can't just stick with what you have. It becomes more and more corrupt. And we have been in a kind of sticking with what we have for far too long. I have hopes for America. They're not unqualified hopes. I'm not quite sure what should happen. So I don't end my book with prose. I end it with a poem in praise of Mario Savio and the free speech movement, because Mario Savio represented a very strong American tradition with Martin Luther King and, of course, Henry Thoreau. And we need that American tradition. And it has a practice of turning up when you most need it. And I hope it will turn up again. And now I think I definitely better stop and take some questions.
That was Peter Dale Scott talking about his most recent book, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. I recorded him on November 9, 2014, at City Lights Bookstore and Publishing House in San Francisco's North Beach. Peter Dale Scott is a Canadian-born former diplomat and retired professor of literature at UC Berkeley. He's the author of many books and articles on state terrorism, surveillance, drug dealing by the CIA, and political assassinations. Come back when TUC Radio returns to hear a very lively Q&A session. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. You can get information on how to order a one-hour CD at cost on tucradio.org or by calling 1-707-463-2654. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. TUC Radio's mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. That's Calpella, California, 95418. For more information, call 707-463-2654. Or go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.